This is Chatham House. Ben Shepherd is an associate fellow with the Africa Programme. He looks at the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ben, to the casual observer from the outside, we just saw the DRC pop up in the news again a few weeks ago when rebels attacked Goma. It seems to be stuck in a cycle.
Mm. It certainly gives that impression, and the tenor of the majority of media coverage of the DRC is rooted in specific crises. So when it pops up onto people's agenda, it's always the same story of humanitarian suffering, of displacement, of violence. And that obviously is a true reflection to some extent of events, but it doesn't capture the political reality of why things are happening.
So tell us about the politics then.
Well, I think to a lot of observers, myself included, it has felt like we've been stuck in a never-ending cycle. The roots of it go back to the Second Congo War, which ran, formally speaking, from 1998 to 2003. When the war ended, there was a three-year political transition that led to elections in 2006, which was the election of the current president, Joseph Kabila. One of the unfortunate corollaries of that was that one of the major parties to that war, a rebel group called the RCD that had controlled a third of the country, so a big chunk of the country, did very, very badly indeed in those elections. It got more or less no representation. So in the immediate post-election period, there was a realisation that while the RCD retained quite a lot of military capacity, it was a former rebel group, it had formed units of relatively capable fighters, it had no political capacity at all, no political weight.
So the RCD are armed, they have significant numbers, but they don't have representation.
That's exactly right.
And that sort of sets the scene for...
Well, that sets the scene for the first iteration of the post-transition violence, which was that elements of the RCD military formed into a new rebel movement called the CNDP, which was led by a dissident general called Laurent Nkunda, who became very famous around 2007-8-9. He had refused integration into the National Army and had maintained control over quite a substantial number of armed men who occupied and dominated an area of North Kivu, which is one of the key provinces in eastern Congo. Part of what motivated Laurent Nkunda was defending the gains that had been made by people who'd been involved with the RCD during the years they were ruling the east of the DRC. So people had made quite significant gains in terms of controlling business, in terms of profits being made. And to some extent, the CNDP was a reflection of people being frightened of losing that advantage as the government retook control, the government in Kinshasa retook control of these areas that had been out of their hands for a very long time.
So when does that bring us up to?
Well, that brings us through 2006-7-8. There were repeat attempts by the government to defeat the CNDP militarily. They were unable to do so. There were also a number of attempts to come to a negotiated agreement with them. The last one of those negotiated attempts, and the one that stuck, at least for a little while, was reached on March 23rd, 2009. That saw CNDP combatants integrated into the National Armed Forces. It happened after Laurent Nkunda was arrested, and he was arrested by Rwanda and put under house arrest in Rwanda, where he remains to this day. And that development was very much a product of a political deal that was reached between the Congolese government and the Rwandan government. So that March 29th deal essentially exchanged the arrest of Laurent Nkunda for the nominal integration of CNDP combatants into the National Army. So they were rehatted. They were given ranks in the National Army. But what they weren't is redeployed away from those areas of North Kivu they'd been dominating. So although technically they were now Congolese soldiers, in practice they maintained the dominance over those areas of North Kivu and over the businesses. They even extended their control to some new mining areas.
So that was 2009 up until this year?
Up until the beginning of this year, that's right. At the beginning of this year, the Congolese government started trying to deploy former CNDP combatants who are now in the Congolese military outside the Kivus. So to move them around, to treat them like any other member of the Congolese armed forces, which would obviously have weakened their hold over the area that they had previously been controlling. And at the same time, there was pressure from the international community for the Congolese government to arrest a CNDP leader called Bosco Ntaganda, who is indicted by the International Criminal Court, is a long-standing rebel. He was indicted for activities in a rebel group in an area called Ituri, which is further north from the area of Eastern Congo that we're talking about, in 2003, so it's going back quite a long way, for recruiting child soldiers. So he's an indicted war criminal. He became the head of the CNDP military, in essence, after Laurent Nkunda was arrested. So he played a key part in maintaining this fiction that the CNDP was part of the Congolese army. So when the Congolese government decided to go after him, to try and arrest him, that in part stimulated the formation of a new rebellion. So in early 2012, the M23 is born. Called the M23 because of the political agreement that was reached on March 23rd, 2009, which M23 rebels claimed wasn't being respected. The essence of their complaint was that they weren't being treated properly, they weren't being given the ranks they'd been promised, they weren't being looked after by the Congolese military. And it's true to say the Congolese military is deeply dysfunctional, so the living conditions for any soldier in the Congolese military are very, very difficult. But that was the trigger for this latest rebellion, the famous M23. The M23, to some extent, represented exactly the same dynamic as the CNDP had and the RCD had before that. So you see it in a historical perspective. The M23 is just the latest iteration of a movement that has existed to defend, in essence, you know, it's much more complicated than this, but I think it's illustrative, to defend the gains that have been made under the RCD when it was controlling Third of Congo during the war.
So we're back into the loop, into the cycle.
Back into the cycle. So when you look at it from that perspective, it looks like this is just the latest version of a problem that's been recurring and recurring. And it's frankly fairly depressing.
Although I think you said you were optimistic.
Well, this is the thing. The M23 took things further than the CNDP ever had. The CNDP had threatened Goma, which is the capital of North Kivu and the main sort of commercial hub for Eastern Congo, on numerous occasions, but they'd always stopped just a few kilometres outside town. They'd made their point, they'd got close, but they'd not taken the town, and they'd backed away. Partly they'd backed away because the UN mission in DRC had opposed them, but mostly they'd backed away because to do so would have raised the political stakes so high it would have risked exposing their allies and, some argue, backers in Kigali, because it makes the whole thing much more serious. It gains the attention of the international community, you know. The spotlight turns to that area and suddenly it becomes clear, or could become clear. So they made their point about being able to dominate the Congolese government militarily, but they never wanted to push it politically that step further by taking the regional capital.
But M23 did that.
So when M23 did that, I was initially slightly confused. It was a change from what had felt like an established pattern. And my reading of that is that they did so because M23 was running out of support. The traditional community base, and I use the word advisedly, of the RCD, the CNDP and the M23 has been the Rwandan-speaking Congolese population. And within that, the Tutsi Congolese population, of which there are a very large number who arrived in successive waves of migration, some as long ago as the mid-19th century, some much more recently. But where with the RCD, this is going back as far as 1998, the community was relatively united in supporting that rebel movement. That support has since fractured. As it's become clear to different elements of those communities that by getting involved in another armed rebellion, they were only making their lives more difficult. They were wrecking the local economy. They were stirring up hatred against the Congolese Tutsi community, of which there is a very great deal amongst other Congolese communities, very deep suspicion. So the support for these armed groups has dwindled. And as that's happened, the number of armed men they've been able to call on has come down. So the RCD maybe had 20,000 troops, the CNDP had something like 6,000, M23 has maybe 1,000, 1,500.
But they're a smaller number, so they're fighting extra hard.
They're fighting extra hard. They're not able to dominate territory in the same way as the others were. So they only control a very small proportion of territory. They're very effective. When they go up against the Congolese military, they tend to win, but there aren't enough of them to hold big swathes of territory. And at the same time, the sort of political backing from elements of the Congolese community has withered away as well, because Congolese people, Hutu and Tutsi, from all backgrounds, are tired of war, essentially. You know, all those years of fighting haven't brought them any advantage. I think there are some specific individuals who make a great deal of money, but, you know, as a mass movement, it doesn't really make sense. So the M23 has been, unable to establish itself as a meaningful or even semi-permanent force, in my view. So when they went to take, when they took Goma, sorry, just to get back to the point, they took Goma, for me, it was a final roll of the dice. It was a way of raising the stakes as high as possible, humiliating the Congolese government as egregiously as they could, coming out with rhetoric saying they're going to march on Kinshasa, they're going to, you know, making all these fairly impossible demands of the Congolese government. It felt to me like an attempt to put as much pressure on Joseph Kabila, on President Kabila, as possible, in the hope that he would, you know, make concessions, sue for peace, give them what they wanted. He didn't. He refused to reintegrate them into the Congolese army. He refused to even talk to them for a long time. And the spotlight, as predicted, turned towards Rwanda and the fact that the Rwandan troops had been supporting the M23. Rwanda had been, according to UN evidence, had been instrumental in the establishment of the M23, been helping with logistics, with supply, with all of that stuff. And that led to pressure on the Rwandan government. They've had aid cuts. They've had aid frozen.
Just in the past few weeks since the attack?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, UK aid, for instance, was suspended in June, I believe, this year. Then it was partially reinstated. And then it's been, again, the latest tranche, which is, I think, £21 million of direct budgetary support, has been frozen. So, for me, the reason I'm slightly optimistic is that gambit seems to have failed. And it's failed, I think, because the M23 has become too thin, both politically and militarily, to disguise the level of Rwandan support that it needed to even be self-sustaining, let alone attempt to take on a bigger agenda. So they're now engaged in talks in Kampala with the Congolese government. Neither side is giving ground, partly because I think the Congolese government realised it doesn't have to give ground because the M23 is a busted flush. M23 because they have nothing else. And if they tried to articulate a political position, it would become quite quickly clear that they weren't legitimate political interlocutors. And actually the people they're claiming to represent have much more legitimate, real community representatives, interlocutors, political actors and parties who should be involved in those conversations. So we have the slightly surreal situation at the moment of peace talks going on in Kampala between a, you know, I mean, it's certainly an important military actor, and none of this should serve to minimise the threat of renewed violence or the damage that could do to the Congolese population, not at all. But in terms of that cycle that we were talking about, feels like that's been broken.
So is that it then? There's nothing else we should be concerned about?
Absolutely not. I think if this possibly slightly naive hope that we have moved one stage on from the patterns we've been seeing in Eastern DRC for like the last 10 years, if that's true, there's an opportunity. And the opportunity is to start to address some of the fundamental structural problems that face the population of Eastern Congo and the fundamental risks that that will evolve or develop into a new conflict dynamic. It's eminently possible. There's a generation of people who've been exposed to war their entire lives. There's vast numbers of small arms, there's huge numbers of armed groups, some of which are extremely brutal. Social structures have broken down, people have been displaced a dozen, 15 times. I mean, the level of need in Eastern Congo is absolutely enormous. I think if it's well handled, these recent developments could open a window for some of that stuff to be discussed and hopefully addressed. And that's where the international community needs to be coming in to support programmes to extend the state, to reopen roads into these completely cut-off areas, to put more effort into reforming the Congolese military. The list of needs is vast. The bill will be enormous. I don't think the international community has the energy to put enough money into it, which is a shame. So my optimism is very, you know, partial. All I think is that there may be a chance in the forthcoming 3 to 6 months that things can shift. And if they don't, and if the opportunity is not taken, then the sort of morass of Eastern Congo is, you know, an extremely fertile breeding ground for all sorts of possible anti-government movements, violent clashes between communities, all sorts of risk factors, which is rather frightening.
Ben Shepherd, thank you very much.
Not at all.